From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories that you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
So I was raised in a totalitarian dictatorship. The dictator was my mom, and in addition to being a right-wing religious ditto head, she was also an OCD neat freak.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories where plans put into motion take some rather unexpected turns.
It rained so bad and it rained so quickly that before we could realize it, the water had risen to where the bridge that connected had gotten covered in water, which meant we were now stranded on an island.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and ARC Stories Media Director, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include one young woman's attempt to have a little fun at some protesters' expense, a boy who is taken on the ride of his life, and a family forced to deal with the loss of nearly all of their possessions.
But in our first story, a guy and one of his friends take a road trip on a Greyhound bus. They didn't plan much, but that's not what makes their trip eventful. Rather, it's the other passengers on the bus. It's from an event we hosted at the Avon Theater where our theme was, on the road, travel stories. Here's storyteller Reed Lockerbie.
When I was a senior in high school, a friend of mine and I took a Greyhound bus voluntarily to Salt Lake City and back to Birmingham. With the purpose of doing something while we were in Salt Lake City. So it wasn't just a, let's just ride the bus forever. But that is what it turned out to be. That turned out to be, let's just ride the bus forever. And I don't want this story to come across as some sort of like anti-Greyhound. I'm sure that's a fine bus line. There was the incident in 2008 where the guy, you know, sawed off the head of the guy he was sitting next to on the bus. Which, I'll tell you, did not surprise me. But that's not the reason why you should not embark on a bus trip like the one that we tried to take. Because I'm sure that kind of thing doesn't happen very often on Greyhound buses. But there are, just to tell you about how terrible of an idea this was, you know, when you have a trip, especially when you're, you know, in high school and you're going, you know, snowboarding and this is going to be so awesome. And when, as the trip approaches or gets closer, you get more and more excited about that. And a good warning sign about this trip was that that's not the experience I had. As this trip got closer and closer, we had bought our tickets for the Greyhound bus a month in advance, which I'm sure was like the first time that's ever happened ever. You could almost hear the guy, you know, like on the other one, we were ordering the like, we want to go and buy those. And you're like, oh, okay. And like drawers opening, like trying to find where's the paperwork for that. But we did. We bought them a month in advance. And so we had a month to sort of like let the excitement about snowboarding, you know, dissipate and let the just growing tension and fear start. Because you know when you buy the ticket that it wasn't slated for this, but it wound up, and it was close. We knew this basically, that it was going to be 57 hours to get to Salt Lake City. And it was going to be 54 hours to get back to Birmingham. I don't know if there's like a bus stream wind that I don't know why. Once again, in retrospect, looking back on it, I'm like, oh, okay, I understand that now. But before the trip, you're like, what? Why would it be different? You know, obviously, I'm not a moron. You know, I know that there's not like a, you know, yellow brick road that goes to Salt Lake City, but you do have somewhat of an expectation that you would follow, like, here, 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 and then, oh, and now you're here. And that's not what happens. What happens on a Greyhound bus is you start here, and you start going, and then you go up, and then you go over, and you go down, and then you go over, and you go here, and you do like a little loop. I'm not positive at some point you don't wind up back farther east from Birmingham. It's a very circuitous route that you take. But that's not the main reason why you should not ride a Greyhound bus. Also, another thing that happens on Greyhound buses is people the bus will stop, not at a bus station. And by the way, bus stations are the worst place. They're the worst place that there is. There's no place worse than a bus station. When you go to start the trip, you go to the, I don't know if you know where it is, it's downtown, and you go to the bus station like at 10:30 at night, which is not, that's not where you want to be. And you wind up in bus stations all across the country at like 2 in the morning and, you know, sitting around. But the point is, what happens is you stop, the bus stops, not just at bus stations, but also sometimes for a smoke break. Which at the, you know, and I didn't smoke at the time, so I had no idea like how legitimate of a reason that was to stop. But then what happens is you get back on the bus for the smoke break and you start going and someone wakes up and says, "When's the next smoke break?" And someone says, "We just took one." And they say, "I slept through it." And the driver says, "I'll pull over." That's something that happens. It's infuriating. But that's not the main reason. That's not the main reason why you shouldn't do what I did. I still have, you know, back pain, I think, that's, you know, resulted from this 111-hour trip. But that's not the main reason either. So basically, to go from Birmingham to Salt Lake City, you go up and you go through, I guess it's like St. Louis, and then you get to Kansas City, and you feel like you're making progress, and then you go through Kansas, which is, if you've ever been through Kansas, and you hear stories about people driving through Texas, and I've never done that, but I'm sure that's bad and awful. Kansas is, I'm sure, equally awful. It's not as large of a state, but why in the world Dorothy would want to return to Kansas is unimaginable. There is not anything there. It is one flat road. You know, the only good thing about it is there's no place to turn. So the bus just keeps going. So it's just one road that goes through Kansas. And when we got through Kansas, and I'd read like 2 Kurt Vonnegut novels or something like that, we got into Colorado, thank heavens. You'll see why in a second. We got into Colorado, about 5 miles into Colorado, and it started to snow, which is... that's exciting, you know, because you're from Birmingham, you don't see snow, you're going on a snowboarding trip, it's starting to snow, and you're like, this is great, it's way better than Kansas was. And the snow intensifies and gets snowier and really, where you're like, oh, this is maybe too much snow, maybe a little bit. And the snow intensifies so much that the bus driver exits the interstate and pulls into a gas station parking lot. And the snow is so intense that you sit on the bus, just a stationary bus, for 2 hours before you realize we're at a gas station. You couldn't see the gas station. It was just like, just white out blizzard. And after 2 hours, you start to see like, oh, there's a pump there. Like, oh, we're at the gas station is where we are. And the snow lets up just enough to where you can also see a large building that's kind of attached or near the gas station. It's a hotel is what it is. We've been there 2 hours already. And at some point, it becomes clear, like, we're not going to be moving anytime soon because we didn't even know we were at a gas station, right? So that's a pretty bad snowstorm. It was a blizzard is what it was. And They left the bus running. It was warm. It was, you know, it was there was electricity, all these sorts of things. And for some reason, about 80% of the people who were on the bus opted to leave the bus and go and rent hotel rooms, which is not a good sign. You're trying to make progress on a trip, and everybody thinks, well, let's get a hotel room, I guess. And so they did, and even though the power was out, they go and get hotel rooms. And so we sit on the bus for what winds up being 13 hours. At one point, my friend braved the elements and went and called his dad, because we were supposed to be meeting the dad out in Salt Lake City. He was going to fly. He's a reasonable person. And I'm telling you, just on the way out, because you know when you get on the bus, you're like, oh, okay, we're getting on the bus. It's 10:30 at night. The sun is going to come up. The sun is going to go down. Just by the schedule they give you, it's going to come up. It's going to go down. It's going to come up. It's going to go down. We're still going to be on the stupid bus. And that's not even taking into account a 13-hour delay where you just sit around. And at one point, this is the only time in my life that I have seriously, like, contemplated, like, should I sell my body? Like, when I get to Salt Lake City, should I sell myself to raise the funds, you know, to buy a plane ticket back home? And of course, I realize that's ridiculous because, you know, it's all Mormons and they don't even drink caffeine, so there's no market there for that. When we called the dad called Greyhound to say, like, hey, do you have a rough idea of how much delayed you'll be getting to Salt Lake City? And they were like, there's a delay? They had no idea. They didn't even know that we've been, like, 13 hours. But that's not the main reason not to ride the bus. So as the day progresses and the snow finally starts to let up a little bit, and I've tried to recreate like what these conditions were, but for some reason there was a window of opportunity where we could get back. Thank heavens we were in Colorado, so they had infrastructure to deal with the roads and they were clearing roads and we had an opportunity to get back on the interstate. But I don't know if it was because we had to follow the plow, but one way or another, it was like, you got to be ready to go or you're going to have to spend the night at this gas station. And so So someone went to go round up all of the people in the hotel rooms and had difficulty finding them because it turned out they were all in one hotel room where one of the guys had gotten out his homemade tattooing equipment. That was so not the kind of equipment you would want to have used on you that it didn't even require electricity. And he had a line of people. He was prepping, and that's why you shouldn't ride a Greyhound bus. Because there's nothing wrong with getting a tattoo. That's fine. But there's something wrong with being willing to have a rank stranger from a Greyhound bus give you a tattoo, impromptued, we'll call it there's something wrong with that. And these are the people that you are on the Greyhound bus with for 111 hours. And I'm not trying to make it sound like I'm not trying to be an elitist or act like I'm better than those people. But, you know, maybe. So, and that's the time I rode a Greyhound bus to Salt Lake City and back. Thank you very much.
Reed Lockamy is a teacher and a coach. And he and his brother Will co-host a radio show here in Birmingham, and they do some segments for the SEC Network. You can find out more about them at LockamyBrothers.com.
So often, even our best laid plans can easily go astray because of the influence of other people. But what happens when we're actually the ones making trouble for other people's plans? That's the scenario for our next storyteller. Coming up in a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live there. I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, the Media Director for ARC Stories. Remember when you were younger and got your first real taste of freedom? While it was somewhat a sign of maturity, you probably wanted to make the most of the newfound freedom for one very simple reason: to have as much fun as possible. That was certainly the case for our next storyteller. Only in seeking fun, she didn't expect to run up against something a great deal more serious. From an event where our theme was POV, stories about a change in perspective, here's storyteller Jen Barnett.
So I was raised in a totalitarian dictatorship. I'm from here. The dictator was my mom. And in addition to being a right-wing religious ditto head, she was also an OCD neat freak. So basically, we were always either cleaning house or at church. And I kind of had a staggering list of rules that I was running through my head at any one time, because they're all the kind of religious ones that you know. Basically, if it was off limits and Footloose, then I wasn't allowed to do it either. But then there were a lot of really off-the-wall cleanliness rules as well. And a couple of examples of those: I wasn't allowed to touch my headboard or footboard because it would leave fingerprints. I wasn't allowed to walk in the living room because I might mess up the carpet marks on the carpet. I wasn't allowed to leave my closet doors open in my bedroom because it messed up the nice clean lines of the wall. And so it wasn't until I got to high school that I really got my first taste of freedom. Freedom and high school are not a thing I think that most people associate with each other, but I didn't go to a regular high school. I went to Resource Learning Center, also known as RLC, and not a lot of people have heard of it. It's now the school known as Jefferson County International Baccalaureate High School. And JCIB is very often named one of the, if not the best, public high school in America. And RLCers like me really love to glom onto that fact. And so every time JCIB is featured in the newspaper or on TV, we share it on Facebook and we're like, look at my high school, look what my high school's up to. Which, to give you a point of reference, is if like Facebook existed in the 60s and every time the Beatles were on TV, Pete Best posted on Facebook and said, hey, check out my band. RLC was very, very different from what JCIB is now. For one thing, it was, we had school in a really run-down old building in Homewood. It was painted once a year by our parents with leftover roadside paint. So everything in the school was either that caution yellow or center stripe white. We didn't have a cafeteria in our high school, so we had a fridge and a Tom's machine and a microwave. The microwave had a feature wherein it would still operate when the door was open, which was super safe, I'm sure. Out back, we had our own student smoking patio and two student lounges that the teachers were not allowed in. And it was in this environment of freedom and permissiveness that I really started to find my voice. School was different, too. We didn't have class on Wednesdays. If you were an underclassman, you had labs or special speakers, or you just had leisure time and hung out in one of the student lounges. If you were an upperclassman, you either had an internship or you could take classes at UAB. But by far, the biggest difference between RLC and JCIB or any other high school was the fact that students could check themselves out of school. A feature which my best friend Catherine and I used two or three times a day. Once she could drive, we left school as often as we could possibly get away with it. Every morning we would go to Burger King on Oxmoor and get steak biscuits and French toast sticks. And then in the afternoon, we'd leave for lunch or shopping. And occasionally we'd get in sort of WASPy trouble, like we would go to department stores and apply for credit cards. Or we'd have cocktails at one of the Chinese places on Valley. That really doesn't expect high school students, truants, to be ordering Mai Tais at 2 in the afternoon. And sometimes we'd just drive around and smoke and talk. And it was one of these days, we were driving around Southside, and we were coming down 10th Avenue South, and up ahead we saw something interesting. It was this little group of people, and they had signs, and one person had a megaphone. And I was like, ooh, what could be happening here? So we stopped to get a closer look. They were protesting outside an abortion clinic. This is a different time. This is about 87 or 88, and oddly enough, there was no pro-life or pro-choice movements that we were really aware of at that time. There was just abortion clinics, and then we'd heard tell of these people who protested them. But here it was happening in our very own town. Well, obviously, we wanted to get involved. And our first thought was, how can we mess with these protesters? It was a really good idea because you know what strikes fear in the heart of protesters? 16-year-old girls. So we pulled over on the side of 10th Avenue and came up with our story. And our storyline was, I was pregnant and alone. So I really wanted to get into character, and I drew from the only thing I could think of, which was billboards all over town that said pregnant and alone. These were accompanied by girls who were crying with downcast eyes. And I remember I got so into my role that as Catherine escorted me into the clinic, I spent so much time looking at the ground that I remember to this day what I was wearing, which was a denim miniskirt by Coca-Cola, white Keds and socks, and an Esprit tropical shirt, like any pregnant teen. So as we're walking towards the clinic, we see it's like the hive, you know, getting a whiff of something. And the man with the megaphone looks at us and shouts, ladies, do you know they kill babies in there? Well, at this point, we'd had like a low-level giggle under our mock sobbing, and we had to rush to the door at that moment because we both thought that we were just going to burst into laughter. So we open the door and dash in, and this is where teenage foresight does not get you all the way there. We open the door, and now we're in the lobby of this clinic, and it's about twice the size of this stage. Across the walls are posters advertising the latest STD, and on this wall are a couple of rows of girls who really are pregnant and alone. Some of them are older than us, and some are our age. None of them are in denim miniskirts and tropical shirts. They are having one of the roughest days of their lives. And as bratty and snotty and horrible as we were, we didn't have to look at each other to know, to feel the remorse. When the receptionist greeted us, I quickly begged off for a trip to the bathroom, and we went together because we're teenage girls and realized that we had to get out of there as fast as we could, that we had made a mockery of someone else's situation. And what was happening outside was nothing compared to what these girls were going through. So we made a dash for the door and headed to the car. The protesters shouted us a little bit, but we ignored it. We crossed 10th and got in Catherine's Jeep Cherokee. and started to head back to school. Frankly, we both needed a cigarette. And one of the protesters, the guy with the megaphone, starts heading towards us. And I'm like, oh my God, drive, drive, drive. And Catherine's like, I want to hear what he has to say. She rolls down the window and he yells, Catherine, does your father know you are in there? He recognized her from a photo on her father's desk. Her father, his boss. All of a sudden, I felt that freedom begin to unravel and fade away. I knew I didn't have much time left. But in that day, I had felt empathy, and I would never be the same. Thanks.
Jen Barnett is the Director of Marketing for Red Hawk Entrepreneur Development Company right here in Birmingham. She's also a cat enthusiast. Learn more about her on Instagram at JenRedHawk.
For Jen, freedom not only meant fun, but also causing a little bit of trouble. She didn't expect that outcome, but she also had to take ownership of the situation. That is not the situation for our next storyteller. In fact, he ends up being literally pulled along against his will. This story is from an event we hosted in partnership with the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, where our theme was roots, stories about the nature of the South. Here's storyteller Justin Fisher.
I was raised at rural Route 1, Conahatta, Mississippi. Conahatta is a Choctaw Indian word. It means dirty skunk. Now, you talk about the nature of the South. Imagine being from a place that had so many skunks that they named it after them. But that is where my mom and dad, Barbara Fay and Billy Austin, decided to raise me and my siblings, my sister Charmin Lee, and my baby brother, Cody Butale. Now, I know that some storytellers change the names to protect the innocent, but I can't make up names like that. That's their real names. We lived on 40 acres of rolling pasture land, and my father and his father together had a herd of a few dozen crossbred cattle. And depending on the year or the season, there were always other animals, chickens, guineas, ducks, cats, dogs, goats, hogs, and horses. Always horses. And that began my love affair. Winston Churchill was right when he said, there's something about the outside of a horse that's good for the inside of a man. And we had quarter horses and draft horses and nags. But one of the greatest days of my life was when my grandfather, Papa Marzine, brought home a dappled gray Shetland pony. She had long, golden mane and tail, and we named her Goldilocks. Hold on to that picture. I believe Shetland ponies are one of God's great jokes on mankind. We, in our naivety, have looked at little children and said, well, those are small people. And we've looked at Shetland ponies and said, well, those are small horses. Let's put them both together. Not a good move. Because Shetland ponies, if you don't know, are evil. Pure evil. In fact, the longer I live, the more I'm convinced that if God had not used a serpent in the Garden of Eden to represent evil, Shetland pony was choice number two. That's what he would have used. And Goldie was no different. She'd just soon bite you as look at you or kick you if she'd get a chance. And, y'all, I could be up here all night, okay? I could tell you the one where she tried to lay down and roll in the dirt with my sister still attached to the saddle. I could tell you the one about her biting my brother in the chest, holding him as high over her little head as her little neck would allow, throwing him down onto the pasture and trying to stomp him. I could tell you the one about my cousin getting kicked so hard it left a semi-permanent horseshoe-shaped tattoo right there in the middle of his chest. But all of those stories are minus a little contraption, a two-wheeled pony cart. Y'all know what I mean? And we spent many happy hours on this two-wheel pony cart with Goldilocks pulling us around. Now, it was a pretty good setup because you were far enough away from her head that she couldn't bite you. And the frame of the buggy was between you and her legs so she couldn't kick you. And many happy hours. And one of my brothers and my favorite things to do was to get in this little two-wheel buggy pulled by Goldilocks and ride about a mile up the paved road and up to Uncle Rudy's house. Uncle Rudy had two boys about our age, Brandon and T.Y., T period Y period. Those letters don't stand for anything. That was his name. Still is. So me and T.Y. are riding in the buggy, Goldilocks pulling us around the yard, and something snapped. I don't know whether somebody stepped on a toy or a screen door slammed or the fireworks just went off in the little pony's evil mind. I don't know what happened. But as T.Y. was getting out of the buggy and reached to hand me the reins, she spooked. Threw her head, and before I had the reins in my hand, she took off. And I had no reins and no control. Took off and bounded down the big hill toward the road and took a hard right on Highway 492. Now, in case you don't know, Highway 492 is the busiest road between Sebastopol and Conahatta, Mississippi. There may be four or five cars a day go up and down this road. Y'all understand? But it don't take but one to have a real bad wreck with a Shetland pony and a crippled boy all in the middle of it. Now, when Goldie took that hard right and landed on 492, as we say where I'm from, y'all, she was hunting some yonder. I mean, she was digging, y'all. And my dad saw what was happening, jumped up off the porch, and came running down the hill. He was going to head us off, as they say, at the pass. But he was too late. As we went by, the only thing he could say was, "Hold on." Which I now know is the biggest understatement ever uttered by mankind in historium, because I wanted to yell back at him, "What do you think I'm doing?" Goldie had been up and down this road so many times that she stayed in her lane, running fast as her little spotted legs could go, but staying in her lane. And we did meet one car. This car was driven by Miss Etol Thrash. Miss Etol had gotten on up in years to the point where she drove her car staring between the dashboard and the steering wheel. You know what I mean? And I was scared to death. I ain't gonna lie about it. And I was yelling and waving, "Help! Help!" And Miss Etol saw me and she just waved back. Just gave me the old glad hand, you know? I wish I could say at this point in the story, like a scene out of some John Wayne movie, that I now leapt from the buggy onto the horse's back, put her in the headlock, bit her ear, and just wrestled her down to the ground and saved myself. But that's not what happened. What happened was Uncle Rudy jumped in his 1967 Volkswagen van, came flying down Highway 492 and passed us, moved over into her lane, slowed down, slowed down, slowed down. And as Goldie went to pass him, in one motion, he slammed the van in park, jumped out, grabbed the reins, and rescued us from a near tragedy. Now, the punchline of the story is that when Dad finally caught up to us, got back in the buggy and took the reins, he leaned over and said, "Don't tell your mama." Thanks for letting me share the story.
Justin Fisher is a writer and economics instructor at Jefferson State Community College. You can learn more about him at his website, can'tevenwalk.com.
To me, Justin exemplifies something we've discovered to be true here in Birmingham. Not only are there so many people with such great stories to tell, but anyone can tell a great story. Being from the South and living in the South seems to make a lot of us just natural-born storytellers. And that's true about our next storyteller. And his story is not only entertaining, but also really moving, because it's about a time his family was faced with tragedy. That's next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live there. I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, the Media Director for ARC Stories. Remember when you were younger and got your first real taste of freedom? While it was somewhat a sign of maturity, you probably wanted to make the most of the newfound freedom for one very simple reason: to have as much fun as possible. That was certainly the case for our next storyteller. Only in seeking fun, she didn't expect to run up against something a great deal more serious. From an event where our theme was POV, stories about a change in perspective, here's storyteller Jen Barnett.
So I was raised in a totalitarian dictatorship. I'm from here. The dictator was my mom. And in addition to being a right-wing religious ditto head, she was also an OCD neat freak. So basically, we were always either cleaning house or at church. And I kind of had a staggering list of rules that I was running through my head at any one time, because they're all the kind of religious ones that you know. Basically, if it was off limits and footloose, then I wasn't allowed to do it either. But then there were a lot of really off-the-wall cleanliness rules as well. And a couple of examples of those: I wasn't allowed to touch my headboard or footboard because it would leave fingerprints. I wasn't allowed to walk in the living room because I might mess up the carpet marks on the carpet. I wasn't allowed to leave my closet doors open in my bedroom because it messed up the nice clean lines of the wall. And so it wasn't until I got to high school that I really got my first taste of freedom. freedom and high school are not a thing I think that most people associate with each other. But I didn't go to a regular high school. I went to Resource Learning Center, awesome, also known as RLC, and not a lot of people have heard of it. It's now the school known as Jefferson County International Baccalaureate High School. And JCIB is very often named one of the, if not the best, public high school in America. And RLCers like me really love to glom onto that fact. And so every time JCIB is featured in the newspaper or on TV, we share it on Facebook and we're like, look at my high school, look what my high school's up to. Which, to give you a point of reference, is if like Facebook existed in the 60s and every time the Beatles were on TV, Pete Best posted on Facebook and said, hey, check out my band. RLC was very, very different from what JCIB is now. For one thing, it was we had school in a really run-down old building in Homewood. It was painted once a year by our parents with leftover roadside paint. So everything in the school was either that caution yellow or center stripe white. We didn't have a cafeteria in our high school, so we had a fridge and a Tom's machine and a microwave. The microwave had a feature wherein it would still operate when the door was open, which was super safe, I'm sure. Out back, we had our own student smoking patio and two student lounges that the teachers were not allowed in. And it was in this environment of freedom and permissiveness that I really started to find my voice. School was different, too. We didn't have class on Wednesdays. If you were an underclassman, you had labs or special speakers, or you just had leisure time and hung out in one of the student lounges. If you were an upperclassman, you either had an internship or you could take classes at UAB. But by far, the biggest difference between RLC and JCIB or any other high school was the fact that students could check themselves out of school. A feature which my best friend Catherine and I used two or three times a day. Once she could drive, we left school as often as we could possibly get away with it. Every morning we would go to Burger King on Oxmoor and get steak biscuits and French toast sticks. And then in the afternoon, we'd leave for lunch or shopping. And occasionally, we'd get in sort of waspy trouble. Like, we would go to department stores and apply for credit cards. Or we'd have cocktails at one of the Chinese places on Valley. That really doesn't expect high school students, truants, to be ordering Mai Tais at 2 in the afternoon. And sometimes we'd just drive around and smoke and talk. And it was one of these days, we were driving around Southside, and we were coming down 10th Avenue South, and up ahead we saw something interesting. It was this little group of people, and they had signs, and one person had a megaphone. And I was like, ooh, what could be happening here? So we stopped to get a closer look. They were protesting outside an abortion clinic. This is a different time. This is about 87 or 88, and oddly enough, there was no pro-life or pro-choice movements that we were really aware of at that time. There was just abortion clinics, and then we'd heard tell of these people who protested them. But here it was happening in our very own town. Well, obviously, we wanted to get involved. And our first thought was, how can we mess with these protesters? It was a really good idea because you know what strikes fear in the heart of protesters? 16-year-old girls. So we pulled over on the side of 10th Avenue and came up with our story. And our storyline was, I was pregnant and alone. So I really wanted to get into character, and I drew from the only thing I could think of, which was billboards all over town that said pregnant and alone. these were accompanied by girls who were crying with downcast eyes. And I remember I got so into my role that as Catherine escorted me into the clinic, I spent so much time looking at the ground that I remember to this day what I was wearing, which was a denim miniskirt by Coca-Cola, white Keds and socks, and an Esprit tropical shirt, like any pregnant teen. So as we're walking towards the clinic, we see it's like the hive, you know, getting a whiff of something. And the man with the megaphone looks at us and shouts, "Ladies, do you know they kill babies in there?" Well, at this point, we'd had like a low-level giggle under our mock sobbing, and we had to rush to the door at that moment because we both thought that we were just going to burst into laughter. So we open the door and dash in, and this is where teenage foresight does not get you all the way there. We open the door, and now we're in the lobby of this clinic, and it's about twice the size of this stage. Across the walls are posters advertising the latest STD, and on this wall are a couple of rows of girls who really are pregnant and alone. Some of them are older than us, and some are our age. None of them are in denim miniskirts and tropical shirts. They are having one of the roughest days of their lives. And as bratty and snotty and horrible as we were, we didn't have to look at each other to know, to feel the remorse. When the receptionist greeted us, I quickly begged off for a trip to the bathroom, and we went together because we're teenage girls and realized that we had to get out of there as fast as we could, that we had made a mockery of someone else's situation. And what was happening outside was nothing compared to what these girls were going through. So we made a dash for the door and headed to the car. The protesters shouted us a little bit, but we ignored it. We crossed 10th and got in Catherine's Jeep Cherokee and started to head back to school. Frankly, we both needed a cigarette. And one of the protesters, the guy with the megaphone, starts heading towards us. And I'm like, oh my God, drive, drive, drive. And Catherine's like, I'm gonna hear what he has to say. She rolls down the window and he yells, "Catherine, does your father know you are in there?" He recognized her from a photo on her father's desk, her father, his boss. All of a sudden, I felt that freedom begin to unravel and fade away. I knew I didn't have much time left. But in that day, I had felt empathy, and I would never be the same. Thanks.
Jen Barnett is the Director of Marketing for Red Hawk Entrepreneur Development Company right here in Birmingham. She's also a cat enthusiast. Learn more about her on Instagram at JenRedHawk.
For Jen, freedom not only meant fun, but also causing a little bit of trouble. She didn't expect that outcome, but she also had to take ownership of the situation. That is not the situation for our next storyteller. In fact, he ends up being literally pulled along against his will. This story is from an event we hosted in partnership with the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, where our theme was roots, stories about the nature of the South. Here's storyteller Justin Fisher.
I was raised at rural Route 1, Conahatta, Mississippi. Conejada is a Choctaw Indian word. It means dirty skunk. Now, you talk about the nature of the South. Imagine being from a place that had so many skunks that they named it after them. But that is where my mom and dad, Barbara Fay and Billy Austin, decided to raise me and my siblings, my sister Charmin Lee, and my baby brother Cody Butale. Now, I know that some storytellers change the names to protect the innocent, but I can't make up names like that. That's their real names. We lived on 40 acres of rolling pasture land. And my father and his father together had a herd of a few dozen crossbred cattle. And depending on the year or the season, there were always other animals, chickens, guineas, ducks, cats, dogs, goats, hogs, and horses. Always horses. And that began my love affair. Winston Churchill was right when he said, there's something about the outside of a horse that's good for the inside of a man. And we had quarter horses and draft horses and nags. But one of the greatest days of my life was when my grandfather, Papa Marzine, brought home a dappled gray Shetland pony. She had long golden mane and tail, and we named her Goldilocks. Hold on to that picture. I believe Shetland ponies are one of God's great jokes on mankind. We, in our naivety, have looked at little children and said, well, those are small people. And we've looked at Shetland ponies and said, well, those are small horses. Let's put them both together. Not a good move. Because Shetland ponies, if you don't know, are evil. Pure evil. In fact, the longer I live, the more I'm convinced that if God had not used a serpent in the Garden of Eden to represent evil, Shetland pony was choice number two. That's what he would have used. And Goldie was no different. She'd just soon bite you as look at you or kick you if she'd get a chance. And, y'all, I could be up here all night, okay? I could tell you the one where she tried to lay down and roll in the dirt with my sister still attached to the saddle. I could tell you the one about her biting my brother in the chest, holding him as high over her little head as her little neck would allow, throwing him down onto the pasture and trying to stomp him. I could tell you the one about my cousin getting kicked so hard it left a semi-permanent horseshoe-shaped tattoo right there in the middle of his chest. But all of those stories are minus a little contraption, a two-wheeled pony cart. Y'all know what I mean? And we spent many happy hours on this two-wheeled pony cart with Goldilocks pulling us around. Now, it was a pretty good setup because you were far enough away from her head that she couldn't bite you. And the frame of the buggy was between you and her legs so she couldn't kick you. And many happy hours. And one of my brothers and my favorite things to do was to get in this little two-wheel buggy pulled by Goldilocks and ride about a mile up the paved road and up to Uncle Rudy's house. Uncle Rudy had two boys about our age, Brandon and T.Y., T period Y period. Those letters don't stand for anything. That was his name. Still is. So me and T.Y. are riding in the buggy, Goldilocks pulling us around the yard, and something snapped. I don't know whether somebody stepped on a toy or a screen door slammed or the fireworks just went off in the little pony's evil mind. I don't know what happened. But as T.Y. was getting out of the buggy and reached to hand me the reins, she spooked, threw her head, and before I had the reins in my hand, she took off. And I had no reins and no control. Took off and bounded down the big hill toward the road and took a hard right on Highway 492. Now, in case you don't know, Highway 492 is the busiest road between Sebastopol and Conahatta, Mississippi. There may be four or five cars a day go up and down this road. Y'all understand? But it don't take but one to have a real bad wreck with a Shetland pony and a crippled boy all in the middle of it. Now, when Goldie took that hard right and landed on 492, as we say where I'm from, y'all, she was hunting some yonder. I mean, she was digging, y'all. And my dad saw what was happening, jumped up off the porch, and came running down the hill. He was going to head us off, as they say, at the pass. But he was too late. As we went by, the only thing he could say was, "Hold on," which I now know is the biggest understatement ever uttered by mankind in historium, because I wanted to yell back at him, "What do you think I'm doing?" Goldie had been up and down this road so many times that she stayed in her lane, running fast as her little spotted legs could go, but staying in her lane. And we did meet one car. This car was driven by Miss Etol Thrash. Miss Etol had gotten on up in years to the point where she drove her car staring between the dashboard and the steering wheel. You know what I mean? And I was scared to death. I ain't gonna lie about it. And I was yelling and waving, "Help! Help!" And Miss Etol saw me and she just waved back. Just gave me the old glad hand, you know? I wish I could say at this point in the story, like a scene out of some John Wayne movie, that I now leapt from the buggy onto the horse's back, put her in the headlock, bit her ear, and just wrestled her down to the ground and saved myself. But that's not what happened. What happened was Uncle Rudy jumped in his 1967 Volkswagen van, came flying down Highway 492 and passed us, moved over into her lane, slowed down, slowed down, slowed down. And as Goldie went to pass him, in one motion, he slammed the van in park, jumped out, grabbed the reins, and rescued us from a near tragedy. Now, the punchline of the story is that when Dad finally caught up to us, got back in the buggy and took the reins, he leaned over and said, "Don't tell your mama." Thanks for letting me share the story.
Justin Fisher is a writer and economics instructor at Jefferson State Community College. You can learn more about him at his website, can'tevenwalk.com.
To me, Justin exemplifies something we've discovered to be true here in Birmingham. Not only are there so many people with such great stories to tell, but anyone can tell a great story. Being from the South and living in the South seems to make a lot of us just natural-born storytellers. And that's true about our next storyteller. And his story is not only entertaining, but also really moving, because it's about a time his family was faced with tragedy. That's next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.